Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
Previously on our transatlantic midweek Zoomers, we featured the awesomely talented Stacey Souther, but we forgot to really mention one of the key elements that he's involved with, obviously with Valerie Perrine, in terms of the fundraising for Parkinson's. So not only that, but he's a wonderful person in any case. Welcome back, Stacey Souther. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
Fantastic. And we've also got our regular ace BAFTA award-winning director. We've worked together, what, nigh on 40 years, Graham, in many ways. It's Graham Harper. How are you, Graham?
Very well, thank you very much. Hello, Stacey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, very good to meet you.
You too.
And of course, this week, Graham, we're seeing that several of the shows that you've worked on, Coronation Street, EastEnders and so on, have all sort of started their socially distanced reshooting again with suitably placed dividers and such like. So interesting times. Have you got the call to go up to Brookside as yet?
Not Brookside.
Holyoaks. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking you were time travelling there, Graham. It's all right. Holyoaks.
Holyoaks, you mean? And I have, yeah.
Excellent.
I'm looking forward to seeing how that all works, but I'm also worried at the moment. So, because
Graham, just get the cast talking to tennis balls and it'll be fine. That's all we need to do.
I'm looking forward to seeing the big kissing scenes. I suppose they won't happen anymore.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Stacey, it's good to connect with your good self. And of course, I went out and ensured that this little gem was still actually sort of at the forefront of all sorts of things. Graham, if you haven't seen this movie, I would urge you to get hold of it. It's a feel-good movie of the 80s, even though, as Stacey said last week, it was launched at a week when Time magazine said, "Disco is dead."
Never.
Stop the music. You should totally check it out. It's a hidden gem nowadays. It's a cult classic. But like you just said, it's a feel-good movie.
Yeah, I'll look at that. It was directed, of course, by a Nancy Walker, which is, I suppose, a rarity, actually, about 40-odd years ago. A fine female director, of course, was a fine actress herself. Valerie, of course, has the starring role together with the Village People. A pre-gender realignment surgery. Bruce Jenner is there. And you've also got Steve Guttenberg. So, I mean, it's awesome. And again, just watching it again earlier today, I just thought, I think critics have been a little bit harsh on that. And it's nice to see that we can do our little bits to resuscitate it. However, let's move straight into this charity that is very close to your own heart, Stacey, and of course Valerie Perrine's as well, that we want to actually just share how people can actually support help and research for Parkinson's.
Yeah, what it is, it's actually a GoFundMe for Valerie, because a lot of people don't know, but she has Parkinson's. She's been battling that for several years now. I'll give you most people don't know this, but she's bedridden at this point. But she still has her spirit and everything. But I created a GoFundMe just to help with her medical bills and things like that. And it's really easy. You can check it out. There's a website for the film, the Valerie documentary. So it's valeriemovie.com. And if you scroll down, there's a link so you can click and it'll take you to the GoFundMe. Or if you just go to GoFundMe and you put in her name, Valerie Perrine, then it'll take you to the page. And all the whatever money comes in from that all goes for to help with Valerie's care.
Well, obviously, you have all our best wishes and thoughts with respect to that, because let's face it, Valerie, and let's face it, Stacey, I say, without Valerie, you wouldn't be on the show now. It's amazing. But there we are. It's a nice little connection, though. It's all good. And one has to say that the vivaciousness and the overall sort of wonderful joie de vivre that she brings to all of our movies is well worth accessing. And we salute her from that point of view, which is great. Graham, you've had a chance to have a look at some of Stacey's work and links and so on. Last week, of course, with Sarah Huntley, I think we managed to successfully explain that cage fighting is done not in separate cages, but actually all in the one cage, which I thought was a big step forward. That's all great. Graham, any questions you'd like to put to Stacey from some of your research findings so far this week?
Well, no, I'm going to stick with Valerie at the moment and just ask Stacey how you got involved with her. How did she come to be chums with her and also help her in this cause.
Well, what happened is we actually, we live in the same neighborhood, and in 2006, we literally bumped into each other walking dogs. I had no idea who she was at the moment because she had the big glasses, the floppy hat and everything. And it was a quick meeting, you know, hey, whatever. And I had no idea who it was. And then we bumped into each other, I'd say maybe a week later. And we just became friends through that. And then we became really close. Another thing a lot of people don't know, she had a major back surgery at the same point. And it really, really, it laid her up for quite a while. Like, I mean, she was in excruciating pain for years. I mean, if you've ever dealt with any sort of a back issue, it's pretty rough. But anyway, so what I would take her to all her appointments and everything. We just became really, really close. And so I've always, the easiest way for me to explain our relationship, she's like my mother. So we have that. And so we're just really close in that regard. And like the way the documentary came about, what happened was they weren't sure what she had. You know, she had essential tremors, which is the same thing that Katharine Hepburn had. She had a little bit of a shake or whatever. But then some other stuff started going on and the doctors couldn't figure out, because she had some symptoms of some stuff, but not everything, and some symptoms of other things. So in the end, she had Parkinson's and essential tremors, but about 6 years ago, she had a brain surgery. It's called DBS, deep brain stimulation. So what they do, they go in and they put a probe into, let's say your right side is, you're right-handed and your right side's more shaky. And they go in and they put a probe in the left side and, you know, they wake you up in the middle of it, you know, because it's the brain, it doesn't feel. So they turn it on and get you to write your name or whatever it is. And then, you know, they kind of knock you back out. So basically what it is, there's a little generator, a little battery pack, like that's implanted kind of like beside your chest cavity, I guess that's what it would call. So what you do, you turn it on, and when it's on, the shaking stops. And, you know, to turn it off, you turn it off to conserve the battery when you sleep or whatever, then you shake again. But, so when that surgery was going to happen, I kept saying for years, I was like, someone needs to do a documentary about Valerie. And it just wasn't happening. And this moment was happening. So I borrowed a camera and I started shooting. And that's how the initial documentary started. So I shot her in the hospital. I didn't shoot the surgery, but I got pre-surgery, post-surgery. I stayed in her apartment with her for 2 weeks after that, just to keep an eye on her because she couldn't be alone. So I slept upstairs in the loft and I would just, you know, make sure she was okay. And there's a couple little spots in the documentary where there's a part where she's getting out of bed and it's the middle of the night. And for some reason I heard her and I don't know why I took the camera down with me. I have no idea why I did it, but it's a great little piece. I'm like, where are you going? What's going on? And she's like, I don't know. I can't remember, but there's some pieces like that, but that's how the whole documentary kind of got started. And, you know, I wanted to share her courageous battle with Parkinson's with the rest of the world, just because she has such a great spirit and she's a fighter. And I think that can go a long way into people, you know, because she is a movie star, people do know her. And I think, you know, showing that these kind of things can happen to anybody, you know, and just show that, you know, that you're not alone, you know, like she, you know, she's going through the same thing, you know, a lot of other people are going through, and she's just trying to face it with as much dignity as she can.
Yeah. Have you finished the movie?
I did finish it. It's done. I'm working right now on a distribution deal. Like hopefully next week that'll be taken care of. And if all works out, hopefully beginning of the year, the movie should be out. It's a short, I've mentioned this last week, I think it's 37 minutes, but the first part of it is all about this incredible life she had, you know, being raised in Japan, post-World War II, then her going on to be a showgirl in Vegas for 8-9 years or so, and some, you know, really amazing, crazy stuff happened there. And then her falling into Hollywood. Like, she didn't come to be an actress. She literally came to Hollywood. Some people were like, oh, you should go to Hollywood, try to get into some commercials. You're really pretty. You can make some money. And literally what happened was, she was at a dinner party, and there was an agent there, and he heard her on the phone, and she was really funny and snappy and quick-witted. And the guy's like, who's that girl? And they're like, oh, that's Valerie. And he's like, she gets off the phone, and he's like, Montana Wild Hack. Because they couldn't find, they were looking for a girl for Slaughterhouse 5. And he's like, wow. Do you have a photo? And she's like, the only photos I have are topless, because I just came from Vegas. So he took a topless photo and took it to the head of casting at Universal Studios. And, you know, she's going through the photos, and somebody saw this photo of Valerie. They're like, who the hell is that? And she's like, exactly. And, you know, she went in and auditioned, and you were supposed to wear a two-piece bathing suit. Valerie didn't have a two-piece bathing suit because she had been in the south of France for a couple of months or something. But she did have some Vegas gear left over. So she went in with something, and the bra type thing,
bra type thing will be fine.
It was cut out. So it supported, but it was showing everything, is what I'm getting at. But the thing was, she wasn't, all the girls were either, you know, shy in their bathing suits, or they were trying to, you know, put it all out there. You know, they weren't used to being, she was used to being topless. It didn't mean anything to her. And she was so natural. George Roy Hill was, that's, you know, he was so impressed with her. That's how she got the part. And, you know, and all the great directors she worked with during that time, like Bob Fosse said, she's the greatest actress I've ever worked with. She's like a sponge. Whatever you tell her, she can do. I mean, that's Bob Fosse. Come on.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's good enough for me.
I think Richard Donner was fairly impressed with her as well, actually, for the Superman gear.
Richard Donner was great. All those great directors of the 70s, like, loved her, you know? I mean, everybody always does, but especially that time when she was just such a huge star and everybody knew who she was. Like, everybody loved working with her, and also she just had so much talent. I'll tell you a funny little story that a lot of people don't know this one. When they were filming Lenny, you know, there's the big striptease scene, you know? And so it was Valentine's Day, and she had done some trimming on herself. And when Bob Fosse came to her trailer, you know, to see her, she opened the door and she didn't have anything on, and she had shaved her pubic area into a heart. And she says, I have a heart on for you.
Yeah. Will that make it?
Yeah, he liked that. And then the crew loved it. Let's just put it that way. The crew loved that thing. And then, you know, she tidied it up, you know, the joke was over. But that just shows you kind of her sense of humor, and she would do anything, you know, she was up for anything, and she would say anything, and she just was very unique. There was no one else like her.
We'll get to you in a second, but what about her family?
Her family?
Yeah, does she not have any family to also take care of her?
Well, she has a brother. The rest of her family has passed away, her mother and father. Her brother's in New York. Odd thing is, in her movie star days, she put him through medical school, and he's a neuropsychologist. So he understands some of the stuff going on with her. You know, it's a blessing to have someone that understands that, you know, the neurology part of, you know, when you're talking to doctors.
Yeah.
But he helps out and everything. It's just, you know, again, it's just the bills become overwhelming because, you know, you have to pay for like caregivers and things like that, you know? So yeah. It's just, you know, it's just, it just gets tough, you know? I mean, when you have to have some, when you have to have, you know, basically almost 24-hour care.
Yeah, no, it must be really tough.
Yeah, but again, like I said, I always like to preference it with, she still has a good spirit, you know what I mean? She's not, there's never a woe is me moment. I've never heard her complain no matter what's going on. You know, she always, she's always upbeat and, you know, it's just, it's who she is, you know, it's that,
And I think it's fair to say, Stacey, that one of the reasons we connected together was, again, that ludicrous line that it was released on Wikipedia that she'd actually died. She hasn't. Yeah. We're still sort of, you know, functioning on that basis. And even though she can't make it onto the show, you know, the fact she suggested your good self and was in touch, that obviously sort of keeps the family going. That's the important thing. Positive vibes.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, not everybody knows the Bob Fosse I have a hard on for you story. So yes. I know. Yes.
I think we'll ease away from that point of view because, you know, we just have to just be a little bit sensitive. Graham, over to you. Carry on the interview, sir.
Stacey, what are you... Well, the question I'd like to ask, okay, you're an actor, you produce and you direct. Which do you prefer?
I mean, I always love acting. You know, I just think that's... It's just such a different kind of way to be creative. You know, producing and directing's, I enjoy that a lot too, because, you know, you can pretty much be with a project from start to finish. And with acting, there's so much that's out of your control. You know, you go in for an audition, you may be the best actor, but you don't look like whoever your brother is supposed to be, who they've already cast. You know, it doesn't always matter like how good you are, where I feel you have a little bit more control, and you have a little bit more, you're just more throughout the whole process when you direct and produce.
When you talked to just then about, you know, being an actor, you're not in control. That's other people have the control of how you're going to be perceived on the screen or whatever. Mm-hmm. I have a big drum I bang all the time at the moment about, especially to young people starting off in the business, about how different it is since I started. I started as an actor, a child actor, and then at 18 or 19, I did not want to do that. I was terrified. What I really wanted to do is become a director, so I changed course. The thing that I really get upset about now, and I still, you know, I'm still an old man, but I'm working. But the thing that's different that I find really sad for both actors and directors is when I started directing in the 80s, we had rehearsals. So I started in television, and we had rehearsal periods because I was in drama. We had rehearsal periods of 5 days, 8 days, 10 days, depending on how big the production was in length of time that you're going to record the next week or whatever. So you can iron out all the problems of the characterization and the motivations and whatever, and you can let actors really have their heart and talk and sort out everything to do with the way they're going to play and what we're going to see in the scenes. And now, so 20 years later, I'm talking about in the late 1990s, that all stopped. The accountants came into television and I'm going to get quickly to it. One of them misses rehearsals and we don't do that. So actors now, they don't even come for an audition. They send a tape in and we all look at that, directors and the director and producers and casting director. And the producer may have the demand of who he's going to have, not you as the director, but you have a selection of people that you like. So at least, you know, you're going to get somebody you care about, and you want to have in the thing. But an actor has to, the thing I'm getting at is an actor has to come to the set with it all sorted out in his brain or her brain, how they're going to play it, and hope that that's what the director wants. And in the 5 minutes or so we have to rehearse and block a scene through before we're going to shoot it, we sort those problems out. And we do, and we managed to get some fantastic stuff out of it between us all. The reliance between me as a director working with an actor and them with me is huge. Hopefully it all works, but I find that very, very hard. Right, I'll stop talking. Do you feel the same?
No, I mean, I love preparation. I love rehearsal. I think, you know, what separates a good actor from a great actor is you know, when they get to the set now, that they are prepared. I'm sure you've worked with somebody that comes in and you're like, they're just not 100% prepared, and it makes their job harder, your job much harder. But when somebody comes in, you know, like pro level, and they just, you know, whatever, even if you have that short a period, like you said, you may have a minutes to talk about what you're going to do, but they bring their A game, and they, you know, they elevate the piece. And again, it's all about collaboration too. That's one thing, like with, yeah, you know, I think that's what really makes, it just really brings that process all together when you can collaborate, and it's somebody, you know, when you're on the same wavelength.
Yeah. I like the collaboration. I use that word a lot because it's not just with with artists, but it's with the crew, with the operator and the DOP, yeah. And the sound guys, everybody, involving everyone. So they really want to come to work and enjoy themselves and enjoy the day and come out with something, you know, it can be tough sometimes, come up with something really, really exciting. When at the beginning of the day, you are not sure about the forthcoming scenes, etc. And of course, day by day, that gets better as you get to know the artists. What are you doing now?
Right now, I'm working on, one of my friends is a writer director, like, you know, a real deal. Like his first movie he did had Bruce Willis and Forrest Whitaker and all these people in it. And I think this is maybe his, I don't know if it's like his fourth or fifth movie, but I'm helping him bring that together right now. So that means, you know, we're talking to some names. We're also trying to get some money right now.
Yeah, you can't get the names without the money, can you? Or maybe you can in America.
Well, you know how it is. It's a catch-22. It's like, how much money do you have? It's like, well, who's attached? And it's that whole thing. But hopefully that one's coming together. And, you know, I've got some other ideas that, you know, other documentary ideas that I've, you know, kind of thought about doing. And, you know, I just try to stay open to see what, you know, just because I know so many people, just whatever comes my way creatively and something that kind of, you know, lights that fire in you and gets you excited. You know, I think it's always good to be open and, you know, who knows what's around the next corner.
What's your favorite part that you've played? Oh, you've gone.
I think he's momentarily frozen there. It's okay, yeah. Stacey, are you back with us?
Yeah, we got frozen there. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I was like, what's going on? I don't know. I mean, I always like the parts that are kind of a little odd, I guess, you know? The odd parts are the fun parts to play, or, you know, or like if you get to play a really good bad guy, those are always interesting.
They're the best parts, aren't they?
Yeah, because, I mean, you can breathe so much life into them. It's not, you know how it is. It's not the person's bad, because what they're thinking, what they're doing, there's a reason behind it. What they're doing to them is good, you know, whatever it is. But I just think there's a lot of, you can have a lot of fun with those kind of characters, you know? You can put a lot of life in them.
I like it when when we can show, or a writer shows the underbelly of the person. So you've got a really evil, nasty piece of work. But actually in order for an audience to like them and enjoy watching them, you need to show, could be comedy, could be a real problem that they're living with that nobody knows about, and to show those little elements so that you really see the pathos and the gentler side of that character sometimes.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we're all made up of so many different pieces. I mean, it's the same when, you know, with a character like that, you just need to find, you know, all the interesting parts of it, you know, of something like that.
And Graham, have you ever considered directing documentaries? Because, I mean, I know we've talked about it over the years, but most of your stuff has actually been in drama and comedy, really. Have you ever sort of thought, I really want to do a Michael Moore?
No, I don't have the nerve to do that. I did, when I first started at the BBC, within about 3 years, I'm working way through the ranks, as it were, I was an assistant director, and I decided to do something about Dylan Thomas. So I wrote, I'm not a writer, but I wrote a three-parter trilogy on the life of Dylan Thomas, a Welsh poet. I'm sure you know Dylan Thomas, a Welsh poet. And because I wanted to. I always dreamed that I would make true life documentaries, dramatized documentaries about real people. I never did. I never have. I took that to an audition to get a job in a particular department of the BBC, which did documentaries about biographies about people. I didn't get the job, and a year and a half later, Dylan Thomas' story was on. It was not my story, but the man that I went to see to get the job produced a Dylan Thomas story, and I always
do not go gently into that night, Graham. Rage against the night.
I was angry. Boy, was I angry. I didn't ever get into it. But I actually started. It was the point I was making. Was I actually started in my heart wanting to do biographies? Yeah.
No, it's great. The only thing I feel with documentaries is they can be time consuming. You know, depending on what your subject is. I mean, again, the one that I did, I mean, from start to now, it's 6 years.
Wow.
You know? But I also, you know, I also took my time, and, you know, I had to get interviews with people, and that the interview part, nailing down actors, you know, because their schedules, they're working and whatnot. That's one of the things that that took a while.
Where are you? Are you in L.A.?
Yeah, I'm in L.A. I'm actually at Valerie's right now. There's her. I mean, you can see it. That's her right there, basically.
Yes, it's brilliant.
Thankfully, we haven't actually gone down to any of the lower parts of this particular stage or the nether region. So step away. It's not that kind of Zoom call. Yes, just hold it there, Stacey. Just hold it there. That's all we're saying.
Keep it PG.
Stacey, very briefly, we mentioned, obviously, You Cannot Kill David Arquette. Is that available online, downloadable, etc.?
Oh, that looks superb.
Yeah, You Cannot Kill David Arquette is available on pretty much all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Amazon Prime, like any of the things. Right now, it's still a purchase, but anywhere where you can purchase anything that streams, it's on there. And it's been really blowing up. I think it was like number 3 on iTunes, I think, maybe last week. I'm not sure what it is this week. Yeah, I mean, anybody that, it doesn't matter if you're a wrestling fan or a David Arquette fan, it just has a very human story. It's a story of redemption, and you get to see, you know, someone go through a lot of crazy, interesting stuff, and very raw. Like, he showed a lot of personal things that, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have, in his position, wouldn't have shown. But yeah, it's a great documentary.
I've only seen the trailer, but gosh, it was really, really, you really want to see it. It's really good. And the thing about wrestling is, I don't know about the whole world, but we in England know, especially the English wrestling of the 70s and 80s, it all looked false, and it was rehearsed, and it seemed to be not fraudulent, but it was a con. It was snakes, you know, medicine man stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But in fact, they get injured. I mean, in fact, your documentary will show that, won't it?
Yes.
They actually get injured doing it.
Oh yeah, like David almost died. I mean, he really got hurt. So there's a nice section with a lot of blood, if people are into that. But no, I mean,
it's not Can't Stop the Music with wrestlers. Let's face it, you know.
It's not Can't Stop the Music. I mean, but you could take the Village People, like that whole costume part of the Village People, and incorporate that into some wrestling. They'd make a good gimmick for sure.
You've sown a seed there, Stacey. We might well take it up. It could be the special relationship to the next extent. Gonna ask the question. Last week, of course, we closed the piece by wishing happy birthday to Valerie. Did it all go well for her 77th?
It did go well. We had we had cake and champagne for like the middle of the day. Then we had a nice, I went out and brought home a nice Italian feast, we'll say, which she really enjoyed. And it was, you know, a chill day. We usually have parties, but with COVID, you know, we can't really do that, especially just, you know, with what's going on with her. But no, it was fine. Like, she had a great time, and you know, there's a lot of love, and you know, birthdays are special. It does it matter if you're exactly. 7 or exactly. 70. Yeah.
We celebrate the joy. Graham, would you like to put those last two questions to Stacey, please?
Yes, yeah, Stacey, have you had a good conversation with us?
Oh, yeah. No, you guys are great. I love you guys.
Oh, we like you too. And would you come back and do it again?
Of course. And I think we should get Sarah Douglas on here. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I'm up for that. Sarah Douglas, huge sort of fan from that, probably a great actress, etc. So she's up for it. We certainly set up. Graham, have you ever worked with Sarah Douglas before?
No.
Well then.
Clearly, yeah,
yes.
She's great. She's great. You guys will love her. We can talk about it and I can get her on for sure, I'm sure. Like she's such a talented, generous, beautiful soul. I mean, she's one of our dear friends.
Excellent. Well, it will happen. Stacey, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. You will return, no doubt, which is fantastic. Graham, likewise, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link Zoomer with us?
I've really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed meeting you, Stacey.
You
really
too, good Graham.
Then we look forward to meeting again in some way down the line in some Zoom room in the twilight zone of the universe.
Bye all.
It does seem as though we have a situation whereby nutrition is at the heart of everything. We've spoken about this for years, but in fact, around 3 in 4 people in the East Midlands say that they know that certain food groups can actually help them beat diseases. Now, to actually talk us through this very important piece of information, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous folks. First of all, the chef from Kitchen Theory, that's Joseph Youssef. How are you, Joseph?
Hello.
And, of course, the lead researcher at Imperial College London, who's obviously confirmed this research, the fantastic Dr. Kirill Veselkov. How are you, Kirill?
I'm very well. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Kirill, talk us through this particular aspect, because, I mean, we've been saying for years here on Siren Radio and indeed Southside Broadcasting that, you know, you don't put sugared water into a Ferrari and expect it to run well. So, you know, the connection between what we eat and indeed how we stay well and healthy, it really, you know, why aren't people getting this message?
Well, I mean, that's a really good analogy. And actually, when it comes to cancer, different meta-analyses estimated that up to 40% of all cancers can be prevented by modifiable, I have to say, dietary and lifestyle measures. And as part of our collaborative research with the Vodafone Foundation and Joseph User from Kitchen Theory, we are combining the power of machine learning and artificial intelligence, processing power of thousands of smartphones and big genomics data to identify anti-cancer properties of bioactive molecules in foods to design what we call next generation of hyperfoods, which actually from our research happen to be common and everyday foods like carrots, dill, parsley, and others, which contain lots of bioactive molecules with the anti-cancer properties in them.
Joseph, we're often told that it's the trace elements of things like selenium, zinc, those are the kind of things that make a real impact in terms of our well-being, our health, and so on. Is it possible that this system, with respect to both technology, artificial intelligence, can work to hopefully ensure that as human beings, we not only find out more information about what we should be eating, but also ways of actually coping with that as well?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think what's really interesting about this research is it's allowing us to really identify how we can change our relationship with food and look at it as more of a functional element of our well-being. As you rightly mentioned, you know, most of us know intuitively that, you know, what we consume in some way has a bearing on our well-being. And, you know, when you look at the kind of, I guess, you know, Public Health England recently announced an obesity crisis, and you look at like the poor state of metabolic health here in the UK, you know, we're aware that this is coming from food. And as you said, there are, you know, certain elements of food that we've identified so far, like the kind of different minerals and vitamins and carbs and proteins that are both, you know, kind of can be good for us in some way. But what about all the other components that are in our ingredients, and what curative properties do they have?
And Kirill, from the point of view of your research at Imperial College London, is this something which you were surprised at? Has it kind of confirmed your preconceptions about the whole sort of system? Or is it just a case of, well, you know, we're in a world, as we're doing this interview really, where artificial intelligence, computing, etc., is very much part of the whole system. This is just another stage along the evolutionary line.
Well, I was, of course, surprised, to be honest. But this is, I have to say, this is a convergence of the technology. And AI component plays a really important role. But there are many other aspects, like including, for example, analytical chemistry that allowed to go deeper to study the biochemical composition of foods, with the development of technology such as mass spectrometry, for example, that actually enables us to quantify thousands of molecules that literally hasn't been possible before. But then the question is, when once we discover those hundreds of different molecules, how are we going to trace it, how are we going to monitor it, and how are we going to study the impact of these molecules on our health? And that's where AI and machine learning comes into play, I think, because if you can see even a simple combination of three molecules out of 10,000 molecules, that is about 1 trillion possibilities. And if you were to do the traditional experimental methods, that simply wouldn't be feasible. And through the computer simulation, and I have to also emphasize and using cool supercomputing technologies like DreamLab app developed by Vodafone Foundation, they harness the processing power of thousands of smartphones, allowed us actually to tap into this huge data sets to discover some of the properties in everyday foods.
And Joseph, as the founder and creative director of Kitchen Theory, somebody might be listening to this saying, I can't cope with all this technology and AI, et cetera. I just want to go for certain foods, et cetera. Is there going to be a simpler way for your average listener who basically wants to eat well, stay healthy, avoid any of the major illnesses that are actually there? What would your advice be?
Yeah, look, the advice is always going to be there is no one diet, one size fits all diet. It's all about, you know, cook from scratch. Eat a varied diet, make sure there's lots of fruits and veg, download the Hyperfoods cookbook, which is free to download from the kitchen-theory.com website. And, you know, what you see there is, you know, we're not saying that these recipes that we've collected in this cookbook are going to cure anything. But what we're saying is these are a guide just to show you how everyday ingredients, like what Kirill had mentioned earlier, like, you know, your cabbage, carrot, dill,
Spinach. We need more spinach in our diets.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, all of these ingredients are really, you know, essential to living a well, kind of balanced diet. Where, you know, in many ways, this is all stuff, again, going back to what you were saying, that is intuitive. We know that, you know, eating fresh, freshly cooked food at home, focusing on fruit and veg, is going to put us in a healthier place. And that's what we're just trying to emphasize, but putting a bit more science behind all of this.
Well, you've mentioned the connection with kitchen theory there. Kirill, anywhere that people can actually go to online to find out the results of the survey and so on, or Vodafone and such like, where can they go?
They can go to Imperial College website and search for Project Drugs and DreamLab and get all insights about our project. And please also download DreamLab app and help us in the fight against cancer.
Dr. Kirill Veselkov, lead researcher at Imperial College, and indeed Joseph Youssef, chef from Kitchen Theory, and indeed co-founder of Kitchen Theory and creative director, not co-founder, founder and creative director. Many thanks indeed. Take care, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
You as well. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Listen to the sound of the city. Listen to the sound of my town. Is a big show. It's what's happening. Listen to the sound of the city. Listen to the cats on the street. New York is the fans of the Yankees. New York is a cop on a beat. Listen to the sound of the city. Listen to the steeple bells chime. City of bright lights, we're doing our part. New York, the city of fashion, the city of passion, this town has a heart. Listen to the sound of the city. New York is the pulse of the world. None to compare. New York, the parks and the playgrounds. New York is the sweet sound of children at play. Listen to the sound of the city. New York at the dark is to the
It's a well-worn maxim that better drivers arrive alive. I've seen it regularly on the Lincolnshire roads and actually would endorse it, but it does seem as though younger drivers are feeling pressurised by other road users, with 50% of drivers in the East Midlands actually feeling this stress. Now, to talk us through the ways in which some of our 17 to 25-year-old motorists are feeling this pressure to drive faster, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, the awesomely talented television presenter extraordinaire, it's Mel Sykes. How are you, Mel?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very good indeed. I cannot believe that you have two sons aged 18 and 16. That is just unbelievable. I mean, it's just...
not really. I'm 50 years old. Oh, so I think it's kind of the normal age.
I
don't know if everybody said it to me all day and I don't really know what it means.
Well, this is it. You see, you will forever, Mel, be a 28, 29-year-old individual. That's the key thing. It's just the way you are. Anyway, we should progress. We've also got the head of motor at Co-op Insurance, Paul Evans, to talk with us as well. How are you, Paul?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good indeed. Now, Mel, turning to yourself, because clearly both of your children are kind of in this whole area of learning to drive and working.
Well, my 18-year-old is actually going to be learning this year, which is why this was of great interest to me.
Yeah, so, I mean, were you surprised by this finding? Was it a case of, you know, we've heard about road rage, etc., but this is a different line entirely.
Yeah, and also, you know, young drivers usually, they've got this bad reputation for being speed demons and that, you know, that they're not being sensible, but actually this says the opposite. These kids are, well, young adults, are wanting to drive sensibly. They've got the black box in place to help them do that. And all the drivers are getting really aggressive because they just think they're being really slow, and they feel more pressure to do things that maybe they shouldn't do, like speed up, or, you know, if they're at a junction, they feel pressure to go forward. So the T-plate that's being introduced today is to put on the back of the car to just let all the drivers know, I've got a black box. I am adhering to the rules of the road like we all should be. So therefore, can you just give me some time and some space? And I think it's a brilliant initiative, especially coming from the point of view as a mother, because your children getting behind the wheel of a car, that first thought of it, you know, it's you get anxious about it. So it's just one level of security that's really welcomed.
Mel, I well remember my own mum actually saying, you do realise that you're in charge of a ton of metal that could kill somebody now. It didn't exactly help, but what the heck? It's a different line entirely. Paul, if I can turn to your good self, because clearly it was the Co-op Insurance who actually produced this report, Beyond the Box. Were you surprised by this finding? I mean, over half of the 17 to 25-year-old population of drivers being put under pressure to drive faster? I mean, it's almost begging us to reach the stage of, we need autonomous vehicles, we need driverless cars now.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting point. But going back to, you know, what you said about, was I surprised by this research? Frankly, yes. I mean, Co-op was the first major general insurer to launch a mass market black box product about 9 years ago now. And, you know, we've always kind of heard anecdotally about, you know, some of the pressures that our younger drivers face when they're on the road, some other motorists, a lot of the more mature motorists, and you'd hope more experienced and therefore safer. But yeah, I personally was shocked by just how much our younger drivers are being put under pressure. You know, it's not just, you know, people getting up behind them. You know, if they're sticking to, you know, the classic, they're sticking to 20 in a, you know, down a domestic street because there's a 20 speed limit, even if it's a clear road in front. You know, some of our younger drivers are being, you know, people are overtaking them dangerously. How does that person who's overtaking not know that a kid's not going to run out, you know, when they're going too quickly?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, certainly the roads around the Lincolnshire area, they are frightening if you're not actually driving at a safe and sensible speed.
Right.
Mel, I was very disappointed to find that two-fifths of motorists surveyed actually over the age of 26 said that they flashed their lights in frustration at another driver. Over a quarter have sworn at another motorist. You know, road rage, it's not good. It doesn't help in any way, shape or form. Maybe it's just a case of, we also need to have a campaign in addition to this T-plate initiative to actually sort of say, look, take a breath, you know, calm down. It is not the end of the world.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think we've all been guilty of it at times. You know, we all want to get somewhere, and if somebody's seemingly going slowly, it can be really frustrating. I think we're all guilty of it. And you're right. I think we should all just you know, chill out. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, you know, we've been, when you drive for a living, those people have already got that, you know, programmed into them, because they cannot spend their entire day cursing the driver in front when your job is to be behind a wheel all day. And I think we all need to take a leaf out of that book, because there's nothing you can do about it. Just sit and chill out. But it is personalities. It's the way that, especially in cities like London, and you're bumper to bumper and everybody's beeping, you know, it's just part of the culture of the road. But we need to unravel that for sure.
Well, not just that. I seem to recall actually travelling as a young driver across the M62 to Manchester. And when you have articulated lorries on that particular M62 stretch of motorway, it gives a whole new meaning to the term chicken run. It's it can be quite frightening. And I would have thought, actually, Paul, from your own perspective, something like a T plate initiative, which just really flags up, a bit like the green plates, the learn things, that actually, you know, just be aware that this person maybe doesn't have your experience. Maybe they are a little bit uncertain. And if they're in dodgy weather conditions as well, and they're problematic from that point of view, you just need to have a bit more courtesy for your fellow road users.
Yeah, and you know what, as well, because a lot of people who take out the black box, they're between 17 to 25, so, you know, they could have been driving for 8 years, they could actually be an experienced driver as well. I think the key thing here is, you know, there's a reason over and above that we should all do it, but there's a reason that they're sticking to the speed limit, there's a reason that they're, you know, taking extra care, because if they don't, it could impact their insurance premiums. But it is about this whole, you know, the one of the main reasons for doing T-plates, not just about those young drivers. Like you said, it's about everybody else on the roads. Maybe trying to make things a bit safer. You can't make things entirely safe, but trying to make it safer, trying to create, like you said, more consideration from maybe more mature road users to, you know, those who maybe don't have as much experience, but they're trying to do the right thing by driving safely.
Where can people go to find out further information about this initiative, Melanie?
Yes, go to the coopinsurance.co.uk website, and there's all the information on there about the T-Play and the research that's been done.
Well, I've got to say, Mel, that I'm sure from your own point of view, it would be a fruitless question to actually say, have you ever had any road rage yourself? Because you're practically perfect in every way. We know this. It's important.
I obviously have.
No, I refuse to believe that, Mel. I really do.
Okay, you stick to your story about me and I'll stick to mine.
There you go. And Paul Evans, likewise, presumably you take a breath in times past when sometimes you might be exasperated by fellow your road users.
Yeah, it's just about, like Mel said, look, we're all human. You know, we've all done things that, you know, maybe aren't the best thing we could have done in a particular situation on the road or elsewhere.
That's okay, Paul. I'm not asking for full confession. We'll just ease it there. It's fantastic stuff. Mel Sykes and Paul Evans, huge thanks indeed. Many thanks. And hopefully we've put one or two people's minds at rest today. Take care.
Fingers crossed. Thank you very
thanks,
much.
Thanks. Bye.
Performance tire specialist.